My name is Randy Loftus. I am the environmental writer at the Dallas Morning News, and it's also been my privilege to be the chair of this conference, and we're really glad everybody is here. We're going to talk this morning about cotton as a sustainable crop. I'll give a little personal background, as I've told a couple of folks here. I grew up in Georgia, and my we would drive around in the country, and we would see the old cotton terraces from long ago, and we had all these beliefs that from the old days that cotton was a soil exhausting, water hogging, chemical loving crop that wound up with nobody making money except the guy at the top of the food chain. The farmer never made any money. That image has changed, of course, dramatically over the decades. Cotton is everywhere these days. As a matter of fact, it's not just growing in the same places it used to be. But people are often amazed to find out how much cotton is grown right here in this part of Texas. That's part of what we're going to hear about today. And we're going to hear about the industry's efforts to limit the impact of the crop on the environment, and to actually improve the environment where they can. Some are going to say that cotton is a model of modern sustainability. Others may say we still have challenges to overcome. So in that spirit, and in a spirit of friendly and collegial interplay, we'll get started. I would note that one panelist who is in the program, Craig Cox from the Environmental Working Group, is not here. He is ill, was taken with a bad case of bronchitis, and got stuck in Washington, D.C. So he sends his apologies for not being here today. What I will do is I will simply ask each panelist to give us a fairly brief overview of where they're coming from, what their perspectives on this, what they might be able to add to public understanding. And I will wait until their speaking opportunity to do the introductions. And we're going to do this in alphabetical order, which makes it a lot easier for me to remember who goes when. So we're first going to hear from Jody Arrington, who's the Vice Chancellor for Research, Commercialization, and Federal Relations, Office of Technology Commercialization, Texas Tech University. And Jody can maybe start off by explaining to us what the heck all those big words mean.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. Thank you, Randy. Sure you can hear me without the mic, but first I want to welcome our guests to Lubbock, Texas, and to the campus of Texas Tech University. So we really appreciate you guys coming. It's an honor to have you here in Lubbock. I hope everybody's been treating you well and been gracious. It's a wonderful, beautiful place. I grew up just up the road, as we say, in a little town called Plainview, and I'm a two-time graduate of Texas Tech. But the greatest resource here in West Texas that I'm sure you have discovered on your own is not cotton. It's not the energy. It's oil and gas or wind. It's the people. And I hope that's been your experience, but we are certainly honored to have you here. Also want to thank Ron Kendall, my colleague at Tech, for pulling this all together. This has been just awesome. Herculean effort, I'm sure. People from all over the world, so kudos to you, Ron. My perspective, Randy, on this will be from university technology transfer. One of the pieces of my mission at Tech is to work with faculty. We do about $200 million in research across the system, and that research spans from health sciences, engineering, computer sciences, ag sciences. So in the process of conducting research, a faculty member has an idea that they think has commercial value, and so our office comes in and assesses that and determines whether or not that idea is commercially viable and if it's patentable, and then we come up with a technology development plan and a commercialization plan to bring it from the lab to the marketplace. And it's very exciting industry, a $2 billion industry and growing. Somebody said that, or I read somewhere where 80% of GDP growth is innovation, and universities are a big part of innovation and economic impact for our country and for this region. Texas Tech certainly is. And so so we get to work on drug therapies and medical devices and how to make wind energy more efficient and et cetera, et cetera. But cotton is king in West Texas. Steve, I'm always amazed when I review the sort of fun facts about cotton in the South Plains. But my favorite one is that you can with the cotton that's harvested just here, in a third of the country's cotton is produced right here in Lubbock and the surrounding area. A third, some 3.5 million acres, and we produce enough cotton to make a billion pair of blue jeans. Is that right, Steve? That puts it in perspective. So cotton's king and in West Texas, and cotton's king at Texas Tech. We do a lot of cotton research. And as a result, there's a lot of good ideas that come out of that that are in our technology transfer pipeline. We work with the USDA on some basic science projects, but we also work with companies, biotech companies like my colleague and new friend Brent from Bayer Crop Sciences. We've got a wonderful partnership with them. But so whether it's breeding cotton for certain outcomes, you know, to be more drought resistant, or drought tolerant, or virus tolerant, or more resistant to insects or herbicides, whatever it is, you can breed towards those outcomes. You can genetically modify a cotton for those outcomes, and Texas Tech is involved in both of those. We also have we work on cotton seed. You know, my understanding is we do about $2 billion in revenue on cotton lint, but cotton seed produces about $350 million here on the South Plains. And it used to be the number one vegetable oil, cottonseed oil. But it is no longer that, and palmitic acid is one reason why. It's really good for deep frying food, but it's got some nutritional challenges. And we have faculty that are working to lower the palmitic acid and bring more utility of cottonseed oil to consumers. We also have, and I'll just mention one more product that we have worked on that I'm very proud of, and we have the inventor here with us today, Dr. Ram Kumar. But so cotton is unique in that it's fiber, you know, industrial fiber, fine fiber for your clothes. It's also food for animals, so it's in animal feed. It's oil, as I talked about, but we've taken the cotton fiber, and we've created this non-woven cotton, combining the cotton with carbon for a decontaminant wipe. And so this has military and homeland security applications. It's an award-winning patented technology by Dr. Ram Kumar. Ram, can you raise your hand so people can see the famous Dr. Ram? But anyway, it's in the marketplace. Our primary customer is the federal government, and first responders around the country. Lawrence Livermore, lab had a competition of decontaminant wipes, for, toxic chemicals and the like, and which one would absorb the best and adsorb the best, and Dr. Ram's product won that competition. And you can imagine the delight that he had and we had, and the credibility that lends to that product. So you know, just a lot of utility for cotton, and we're excited to be just a small part of that at Texas Tech. And it's an unbelievably fun job, but it's an unbelievably important role for universities, because taxpayers fund research. Federal grants come in, state salaries, state resources pay the salaries of the faculty, and it's important not only expand the basic science, okay, but to actually create some product with value and bring it to the consumers for their benefit and their use, and that's our focus. And then if we can make some money, bring some revenue streams back to the university in these tough times, all the better, and we can advance higher education and our mission. Anyway, glad to be here. Appreciate, Randy, the opportunity.
Thank you, Jody. Probably someone in the room had not yet associated those cotton plants you saw on the way into town with bioterrorism. So we appreciate hearing about that connection. We're next going to hear from Brent Crossland, who's the business development manager for fiber development, Bayer Crop Science. Perhaps, Brent, you can tell us about the role of chemicals and related efforts in growing good cotton, and how what people think of as an aspirin company got involved.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Jody. Very good synopsis of what we do out here, and it is like you said, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm pretty humbled to be on this panel. I don't know necessarily why I'm here per se. I am here representing Bayer Crop Science, but a little bit on my background. I guess maybe this is one of the reasons that I'm here. I came here to this area. In fact, I was just talking to Jody about it. I started my career in his hometown. I hate to mention it now, but it's been over 30 years ago. I started out. I was the enemy. I came from Texas A&M. To this fine country.
One day.
And I had to blow it, didn't I?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I started my career here in Hale County as assistant county agent under an institution. Steve, you knew him, Ollie Liner. He was quite a man and one of the pioneers of this industry, and I learned a lot from him. So I don't want to get into my background too much, but I spent a little over 10 years with University Extension Service, a couple years as an independent crop consultant. Obviously, most of that was dealing with cotton. And then after that, I ended up realizing that I needed to do something else besides being an independent consultant, or I wasn't going to make much of a living. I wasn't that good at it. I joined, began my career then after that with Rome Palenque. It was a crop protection company that through mergers and acquisitions became Aventis, and then Aventis became Bayer Crop Science, and now I'm working with them. I've had different positions with product management with our crop protection products, and then got moved over into our biotechnology side, which is mainly our seed business. So, Randy, I think one of the things I'd like to dwell on just a second is we're about selling solutions. That's what we do. We sell solutions to our farmer customers. Some of that may be traditional crop protection products. Some of that can be biologicals. We have a portfolio of biological products as well. If you kept up with our company recently, we just acquired a company called AgriQuest. AgriQuest, if you look it up, is a company based out of California that deals in nothing but biological type products. So the world's changing. Again, we're about selling solutions. So that's what we do. We're looking at opportunities and ways to help producers and do it in a sustainable manner. One of my major positions with Bayer Crop Science is working on our cotton sustainability initiatives. Just got back from Hong Kong and spent a few days at the Textile Exchange, which was formerly the Organic Exchange. Bayer Crop Science is a member of the Textile Exchange now. So, again, we're about selling solutions all the way through the value chain. And I think one of the things that I've learned is, and I really mean this, and we believe it, sustainability is very important to our company. If you've done your research on Bayer, you know that. We're on the Sustainability Index. We've done LCAs on many of our products. But when you think about sustainability, I heard something that I really believe. Sustainability is not a destination. You'll never get there. It's a journey, And our producers have been working on that journey, Steve, for quite some time. When I first came here, if you could take a snapshot of out here in the country, and some of you have been on the field tours, if you saw that 34 years ago during the growing season, the farmers lived in the field. They were on the tractors constantly plowing the land, trying to fight weeds, pestilence, and that's the way it was. We made drastic improvements. The Conservation Reserve Program came in. We put it back into a lot of grasslands. And through biotechnology and some other different traditional breedings, we now have a cotton production business that's just totally different. You don't see a tractor in the field much. When I first came here, irrigation was flood irrigated. It was mostly just, put through drip tubes out on the ground. And you very seldom saw a center pivot. Now, we've advanced from that all the way to very efficient drip irrigation that's just putting out only what you need when you need it. We've made some huge advancements, and I think you can see that we are growing a crop in a very sustainable manner. We focus on the environment, and for sustainability, obviously, it's economics. And you just look around and think about what Lubbock would look like if it wasn't for this industry. And then it's about equity, the social responsibilities. And that's another avenue that I've seen really change from my work as an extension agent. When I first got here, if you wanted to put out chemicals, crop protection products, whether you were a farmer or a consultant or whoever, you basically could just go buy the stuff and put it out. You can't do that. Not anymore. You have to be trained, you have to be licensed, and now you have to have continuing education units to be able to do that. It's very regulated, and it's in a very controlled situation. So, I didn't come with a PowerPoint presentation or anything, just speaking a little bit from the heart and telling you what I've seen, and I'm looking forward to the discussions.
Thank you very much, Brent. Appreciate that. We're next going to hear from Amy Hardberger, who is an assistant professor at the School of Law at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. And she is also a consultant to the Environmental Defense Fund and is, as I understand, a Texas Tech Law alum and former professor.
Yes. I'm also a proud Red Raider. I got my law degree here. My history with Lubbock actually goes much further back than that. The Hardbergers grew up on 13th Street. Most of my family went to Texas Tech, so I have sort of a weird, maybe complicated, I don't know, relationship with cotton and with this area. My whole family were cotton farmers. I now manage a bunch of our family farms, and I do most of my work is on water sustainability. And so sometimes these two, I don't know if they conflict, but they certainly threaten to conflict. When I have done some work up here, when I was coming up here as Environmental Defense Fund, there was certainly some trepidation when they heard that. But my concern from a, funny that you use the word sustainable because that's what we try to use as a journey, hopefully that doesn't stop, because I certainly would not want to see people having to leave the High Plains. And I think that the reality is if water is used in a way that isn't sort of planned and thought about, that could be the ultimate sort of consequence of that, or whether that be, there's arguments about whether or not that would be in 50 years or 70 years, but even on the outside parameter, 70 years, whatever, that doesn't seem long enough to me. So I've sort of looked at, most of my work has been in municipal areas, but obviously when you look at water sustainability, the big picture, you have to look at all the users. And unfortunately, I think that agriculture has gotten a bit of a bad rap. I think it's easy to look at the pie chart and say, well, ag represents, and I do have a PowerPoint. We don't have to look at it, but I do have some interesting graphics. But I'm a lawyer. I'm used to PowerPoints. I get very mad. I prefer not having PowerPoints, but there is, and I can't remember offhand, but, I think withdrawals in Texas, it's something like 40% of all withdrawals, maybe even higher, is for ag. So, of course, when we look at water shortages, which we have quite a bit in Texas and in other areas recently with drought, ag is sort of an easy target. I think that ag has some work to do. I don't think they're there yet, but I don't think, I think that they need to be looked at in the realm of everything. Municipal has a lot of work to do too. If you, you know, drive through a drought-ridden city and you see green grass, I think that's also sort of, something that we need to talk about. That being said, I think that, that agriculture and particularly cotton, does have, a little ways to go. I think it's a transformative, situation. I think that, you know, a lot of these technologies that have been invented are very helpful, but they're also very expensive. So we have to look at sort of the legal construct and availability of incentivization programs to get these in. You know, drip was mentioned, but I think one of my other graphs, I'm just going to start making up numbers because there's no way for you to look at my graphs, but I think it said that nationwide drip was only, it was between like 10 and 15%. So while it's a very good technology, it is certainly not, we have not seen any sort of market transformation yet. I recently heard that up to 20 to 30% we're still using flood irrigation. Obviously, that's a, I hate using this term, but a low-hanging fruit. We need to work on that. You know, it's hard to talk about water sometimes. I know this is a sort of a national audience. I work in Texas. Texas has very, very unique groundwater law, in that we have very little groundwater law in many ways, as compared to other states. So that is my familiarity. But in doing some review and research for this and other projects, there are several other states that have done, you know, tax rebates, tax incentivizations for conservation-oriented equipment to sort of encourage that. Groundwater districts here, which is how we manage groundwater, have done programs. Obviously, the soil conservation groups have helped quite a bit. But, you know, here in Lubbock, we have an aquifer that doesn't recharge, or at least it doesn't recharge in a realm of time in which we will be able to enjoy the water that trickles down to it. So when you have, you know, what we call a fossil aquifer, you know, being pumped, all that water that goes out sort of in some ways doesn't disappear. I mean, you know, but it doesn't, it's not available for future use. And so when we talk about, I think there's some interesting, and I'd like to hear from you guys because on this is that one of the things that I've heard in talking to farmers is that a positive or maybe a negative, depending on how you're looking at it, is when you put in better, more efficient water systems, you actually get a higher yield, which is great. But the question is, would there actually be a overall water use reduction, or would you use the same amount but get a better yield? Now, that's still a positive because at least you're not, I don't want to use the word wasting water, you're still sort of maximizing the benefit of that water, which, of course, is beneficial, but when we look at overall, you know, water use, I think it can still be somewhat problematic. So, there are also obviously water quality issues, nitrate issues. I don't work in water quality, so I'm not going to talk a lot about that, except to say that in areas where you have nitrate runoff into surface water, if you're also depleting any of that surface water for the actual farming, then you have a sort of a feedback loop where you have less availability for dilution of the nitrate runoff. So that's kind of there is actually a relationship between the water quantity and water quality, particularly in areas where you have surface water. So, you know, we can get more into this when we get into the discussion part, but, you know, cotton is a very, very water intensive, crop, and it is, you know, it is traditionally grown in areas, that don't always have a lot of water. So, it is probably not logical to tell people, well, we're not going to grow cotton here. I actually, as a sort of a side note, a little anecdotal thing, I was speaking to an international group about Texas water practices, and somebody from the Middle East raised their hand and said, well, why do you grow cotton here, or why do you grow rice in Texas? And I said, well, we just do. And they said, well, why don't you just tell them that they can't grow that there? In our country, we have allotted areas based on climate, and we tell people what they're going to grow in certain areas. And I just said, well, we don't do that here. And I was like, that's just not the way we work. And so, and obviously there's good economic arguments for that. I mean, it's not just the cotton farmers. You can't just ask people who have farmed cotton for several generations to switch to something else. I mean, all of the surrounding infrastructure here supports cotton, not corn or grass or whatever. But that being said, I think there is still a lot of conversation that needs to be had and a lot of sort of transformation that needs to be had to ensure sustainability and ensure that, that people can continue to grow cotton in this area for a long time and do it well.
Good. Thank you very much, Andy. Appreciate that. Last, we're going to hear from Andrew Jordan, a sustainability implementation consultant for Cotton Incorporated. You might also explain what that means and a little bit about what Cotton Inc. is.
Well, let me talk about that title. That's a made-up title, and I don't have my PowerPoint, so I really like the premise. If I don't have a PowerPoint, I can make up my numbers.
That's
so,
right. So I
like that. But, yes, I am representing Cotton Incorporated, and let me say I'm representing them after some 30-plus years with the National Cotton Council as director of that technical services there. So I've got a long, enjoyable history of cotton, and hopefully most of it has been very positive. But I am representing Cotton Incorporated. Cotton Incorporated is a not-for-profit organization. It's not a lobbying organization. It's not a trade association. It's a company whose very existence it exists to help the cotton chain do a better job on promoting and also research for cotton. So it's a real privilege to be here, and especially a privilege to visit with you journalists, environmental journalists who have such an awesome responsibility, and I think the awesome responsibility you're here because you want to get it right. And I believe all four of us panelists are here to help you to understand the issues as we view them. At this stage in the program, it reminds me of a friend of mine, a former congressman from this area, Charlie Stenholm, and he said, you know, by this time, everything that can be said has been said. It's just that everybody hadn't said it yet. So I'll get the chance now to give my perspective of mine and also Cotton Incorporated's perspective. The focus of this session is on the land, and I point out that Cotton Incorporated each year will fund and manage some 400 agricultural research projects across the United States with institutions such as Texas Tech, with the USDA, with private industry, with consultants, and in all cases working with their members, and those are the members of cotton growers across the United States, and also in many cases the importers of cotton goods who are paying for this. So all of this is privately funded, with the end point being to do a better job. You know, sustainability, that's that word I'm beginning to want to lose because everybody's using it, and whatever I'm doing, I being whoever's talking, is, okay, I've got a rubber suit, and I'm going to put this rubber suit on the sustainability, and I'm going to call it sustainable. So I think we need to be careful to really look and make sure sustainability is my definition. and that is, you know, I think of the three circles we've all seen. There's a circle of environment, which many of us focus just on the environment, but there are two other circles. There's the economic component and the social component. I have seen in some cases where those of us who want to focus only on the economic component or only on the social component, only on the environment, from our standpoint, we are looking for the sweet spot where we are addressing all of these needs, the three pillars, and that's our company. We consider those are the three pillars of sustainability. That's the economic. Let's face it, farmers have to be in business if they're going to do it. The environmental, and this is where I put on my grandfather hat. At this stage, on this side of my career, I'm really thinking, and I'm dead serious here. That's one reason I spend so much time in it. When I look at my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and think when they are my age, what's the world going to look like? You go to this, and
You know, we're looking at 9 billion people on the earth here in just a few years. The need for food and fiber more than doubling. The last I heard, nobody's making any new land as far as the earth is still about the same size. From my standpoint and others, we want the world and my children to have an environment, a place, natural resources that they can continue to survive and enjoy the benefits that many of us have enjoyed over these years. So it is a very awesome responsibility, and I would say that that we in Cotton Corp are trying to make sure we focus on these issues. Amy, I really appreciate your mention. I really wish I could see your PowerPoint. Maybe you can show me. Because,
I've got family pictures.
Well, that's right. And you're right. There are conflicts. We understand there are conflicts. And if we all had it right, if we were absolutely sustainable and didn't have to do anything else, that would be a wonderful world. But we are on this road of continuous improvement. And a great deal of effort from our ag research staff at Cotton Incorporated, they're trying to identify what are those conflicts, where are the issues, what are the pressure points, how well are we doing. Some areas we're doing great, other areas I see those as the opportunities and the challenges. And that's a very important part of the work at Cotton Incorporated. It's easy for me, being raised on a cotton farm in Georgia. My dad was a volunteer, but very much involved in the Soil Conservation Service, Soil and Water Conservation Service. So that meant on our farm, if there was new practice to be tried and demonstrated from the conservation and natural resource responsibility, it was on our farm. A lot of it worked good. Kudzu wasn't all that good. But I would say most of these practices, when I look back, they were part of this road of continuous improvement. And this is absolutely essential that, Brad, you said, we're not there yet. No, we'll never be at the point where we're satisfied and we don't have to do anything else. It's a matter of continuing to do better. We are making some headway. During the span of two generations, pesticide uses has been cut in half. We are able to grow twice the amount of cotton using the same amount of irrigated water. I appreciate your conflict there. There's still those saying, well, you're still using the water, so what's the big deal? You're just doubling the amount of fiber. Well, to me, that is a big deal because if you need the same amount of fiber or the same amount of food and you use twice the water, that's not a good thing. So it's very important that we walk this fine line of getting it right. Compared to some 50 years ago when I was still on a farm, and I'm sure you weren't born yet, Randy.
I told somebody the other day, I remember when Paladura Canyon was not a canyon yet.
I don't know if I would use that in an environmental group.
Horrible example of erosion gone berserk.
That's right. So we're producing this cotton on one third of the land that was produced many years ago. So you mentioned the life cycle assessment. In the past 2 or 3 years, Cotton Incorporated has gotten dead serious on helping to understand, you know, what's the life cycle of a cotton knit shirt and a pair of khaki pants. What's the life cycle? And this is really complex, going back not only to the fiber that's going in the field, but what are the embedded inputs of energy, the embedded inputs of greenhouse gases, the embedded inputs of water. And you take this fiber from before it was developed to the point of a consumer's washing machine, and this very important part of the water usage, especially environmental uses. It takes so many units of BTU to get the shirt to the retail shelf. And then what happens to the rest of its life. It must be washed. So think in terms of improved efficiencies of washing and cleaning. And even some of the research is, stay with me on this, some of the research is how can we wash our clothes fewer times? That's kind of the concept. I mean, I like to clean, I start to say other parts of my garments, but I like a clean shirt every day. And maybe we're having to rethink some of these. And this is one of the things we in Titan Incorporated, we're trying to think into the future, the things that is not always a top of mind. So, Jody, you mentioned cotton being the food crop. It is indeed a food crop, and cotton is regulated as a food crop as far as the pesticide regulations, environmental quality, food safety, and so on. It is a food crop. In fact, if you are familiar with a little item, kitchen item called Crisco, that is crystallized cotton oil. That's the genesis of Crisco. At that time, cotton, there was a way to winterize it and make it stable at colder temperatures, solidify it and make it look like lard. But it's still considered a healthy oil. It's just that we can make it healthier. And I saw eyebrows raised there. Look at the saturated fat. It is a higher level of look at fatty acid profile. It is somewhat higher level. Some of the research is going on is how can we change that fatty acid profile to make it a even healthier oil. It has wonderful functional properties for baking and frying. Cottonseed is really a nice functional oil. And speaking of that, some people have promoted, well, why don't we promote cottonseed oil as a biodiesel? Well, we do in this regard. We think it makes better utilization of oil. Let's use it as a frying oil first. And then when we use it with cooking our fish and french fries and so on, then we will use it, then recycle that into putting it in the buses and trucks and cars. So we think that is, as far as cotton oil goes, a more efficient utilization of cotton seed. Cotton Incorporated is sponsored with another Texas institution, which I won't mention right here, but we're in Lubbock. Development of a cotton seed, which has a so-called low gossypol level. This is removing one of the components of cotton seed, which is preventing it from being a human food. This is through biotechnology that this work is being done, and it's really interesting concept in which this gossypol is removed from the seed, but it's left in the rest of the plant. This gossypol in the rest of the plant provides some natural protection against insects, because insects don't like to eat it either, that the gossypol. So we've taken it out of the seed so we as humans can eat it and leave it in the rest of the plant to keep the insects from eating it. So very interesting concept, and Cotton Incorporated is our part of it. We will make this publicly available for any geneticist in the world to make it available. And part of my resume is, you don't know, I spent a lot of my time in Africa, personally, on safe drinking water. And by the way, I'm so glad you're not using plastic bottles here for the water. I'm so glad that she's using a reusable water. Because as I visit with my fellow colleagues in water, as a condition of continuing to be on this project, you will not be purchasing water in a plastic bottle. You bring it. We've got the safest water in the United States, and we should not be spending all of it. I'm getting off on another topic. But anyway, let's talk about water utilization. Amy, you mentioned that water is a very thirsty crop. Cotton is really interesting. It is a drought-tolerant crop. It's a survivor. It will survive in desert climates. With continued improvements, we are looking at how can we grow more cotton, more and more, less water, looking at from the not only the management standpoint in irrigation water use efficiency, but also from the genetic standpoint. Water is it's sort of interesting. It's a drought-tolerant crop, but the same token, with the proper use of water, it increases better, increases the yield. So you can say it's a thirsty crop or it's not a thirsty crop, depending on the perspective. In conclusion, I want to mention biotechnology. We learned very early, as the new advances in biotechnology coming online, there is a scary tactic that many people got into using. Okay, I'm philosophically opposed to modifying these genes, so let's think of the term that's most fearful. And I was there when it happened. Genetically modified organism. Okay, you're kind of getting kind of scary there. Let's develop a yuck factor around this. Well, as a condition of continued employment, when I had a staff, you will not use the term GMO. You're just using the most negative term. So forgive me. I know all of us, all of the rest of you, are using GMO as the word to use. That's the word I'm trying to lose. Biotechnology can be used as a safe tool. Can you use biotechnology to do bad stuff? Yeah. Can you use chemicals to do bad stuff? Yeah. Can you use this tractor and car to do bad stuff? Yeah. It's our responsibility to do it right, and do it responsibly. So with that, I'm taking more than my time. I could have taken less time had I used my PowerPoint. But thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Yeah, you can use her.
Andrew, if I said transgenic cotton, I would have put off.
Thank you, Andrew. You know, Morgan Freeman, who hosted those Through the Wormhole shows on the Science Channel, said on some talk show that the danger of hosting that show was that people thought he was smarter than he really was. What typically happens in these panels is that the moderator will then throw out a couple of questions and we'll get a lot of response from them. But I think it's always way better if the audience gets the crack right now. So you had your hand up first. Please identify yourself first, and I will ask that I will repeat the question for the benefit of the recording. Okay, so go ahead. Okay.
I think I understand the point. I think the question is here. We are using biotechnology to have herbicide-resistant weeds, so therefore that promotes more use of those particular herbicides. Is that the point? Okay, let's talk about the more toxic herbicides. I think what the solution is to use a different system, additional chemistry, and the notion that, well, we're using more toxic herbicide, that's not the notion. There are molecules that affect and control the plants differently than the Roundup, the glyphosate. So, I would say, Cotton Incorporated, we've been very, very serious about trying to make sure this did not happen. In some cases, there is resistance of this pigweed, so to speak, to Roundup, which means you use other chemistries. Or you go back to using more cultivation, which we're trying to not to do. More cultivation means more energy for plowing, more energy for cultivation. So the notion here is use a balanced approach, use rotation. These things can be managed. For example, last week I was in Louisiana working with some cotton growers there. And to the point, they said, we will rotate our crops. We will not plant cotton after cotton. We will plant corn on this crop next year, or soybeans, or rice, or other crops, so we can allow different chemistries to prevent this reliance on a single molecule.
Yeah, we at Bayer, we even have a program training farmers. It's called Respect the Rotation, and that's not just rotating crops. It's also rotating the system. In other words, not just using glyphosate, using other alternatives, and it may just be through different means of cultivation. It may mean different herbicides, pre-emerged, things that are labeled, but to try to make sure that doesn't happen. Through rotation, either rotation with crops or rotation with your system, you won't have the resistance pop up.
Okay, we can detail questions like this. We can follow up after the session if you don't mind. Let's get to more people. Yes. I'm sorry.
I can answer that one first, and then I don't want to get into the numbers because you guys have numbers on the water, but I would say that it's going to be extremely variable based on the water uses, based on what the irrigation practices are of a particular field. So I think you're going to see an enormous range in that. It also, you know, obviously is going to vary considerably per year. If it's very dry and you have to pre-water, that's going to be sort of very different. You're going to see a very different outlay. For Texas, quickly, the issue with groundwater here is that Texas generally has a right of capture, which is our tradition since 1906, and which basically means if you can sink a well, you can pump the water. Over the years, that's been somewhat modified by groundwater districts. Some of the groundwater districts up here are actually the most sort of forethinking and front-running in terms of metering and limiting groundwater. The case that's being referred to is a case called Edwards Aquifer Authority versus Day. It came out last March, I believe. And basically what it decided was that groundwater rights are vested in place, which had been sort of a subject. Everybody thought that had been settled. The people on the vested side thought that it was settled, that it was vested, and the people on the other side thought that it wasn't. But the Supreme Court answered that and said it's vested. The impact on that, the potential impact on that is that it means if you have a vested property right in place, that overregulation, nobody knows what overregulation is, so if that's the next question, I don't know, means would subject the regulating authority to a takings claim, so that they would basically have to pay for the limitation of private property rights, just the same as if I said you can't use this section of your land. So the answer is nobody knows. We know now that it's vested. But the court decision did clearly state that groundwater districts still have the right to regulate. So the question then is, well, where does the right to regulate bump into the Fifth Amendment takings clause? And I think it's just going to be a series of litigation to figure that out. The problem with that for those of us that are involved in groundwater management is that there was a chilling effect. A lot of groundwater districts aren't real thrilled to pass or promulgate new regulations because they don't want to be the test case for whether or not it's a takings. I will give full credit to the High Plains Water District up here. They went ahead and sort of pushed forth and passed some regulations that required metering of all groundwater pumps, which I think is a great place to start. If I can just back up for 1 second, I think one of the problems is, or one of the challenges is that I think farming communities, when they're asked to report data, often feel like, and this is exactly what was told to me by a farmer as a direct quote, is the camel's nose under the tent. And if they tell people how much water they're using, it's going to automatically lead to more vilification and limitations. I think that relationship has to change. As a state and whatever state you're in, have to realize that we have one water source that we all share. There's no one sector that's using it super efficiently. So, but that doesn't mean that ag doesn't need to be part of the conversation. And I think to be part of the conversation, there has to be sort of data reporting. So, the High Plains Water District did pass this, and they also have, and I don't remember the numbers, maybe one of y'all do, but a ratcheting down of actually how much water they can pump over a series of years. So there have been some rattlings that people are going to sue them under a takings claim. As far as I know, nothing has been filed. And to be fair, there was a group of farmers that were very, very behind and supportive of those regulations. So they have a real split in their community between people who are very angry and people who are very supportive. So I hope that answers your question. So we don't know. It's a big question in Texas.
As a general rule, first of all, we look as a rule at generally about for each inch of water, you could get 50 to 60 pounds of fiber. So, you know, you want to do the arithmetic and play the game. So it's going to rain 10 inches, and then we will apply more inches of water. But that's the general rule that we look at.
Okay. Thank you. You've been waiting, Jennifer. There you go. Sorry. Okay, so to summarize, the questions are we growing cotton here to ship it overseas for processing, and then it comes back to us, and where is it going? Which countries? And what? Right. Okay. Yeah. What's the international impact of cotton culture?
If I may, and I'm sure others will. But I love that summary, and you described what has happened. Textile processing was in the north, and as labor rates increased, it moved south where people were willing to work cheap. I mean, that's sort of fundamentally what happened. And then, now, I'm going to get to the answer to your question. Yes, most of our cotton in the U.S. is exported. We are very much dependent on exports. We still process in the U.S. Roughly a third of our production, mostly in Texas is a fairly major textile producer, but also the southeastern part of the U.S. But the textile production shifted first to Mexico, then to China, and China is really the major cotton textile production is in China. Even on China now, we're beginning to experience some shifts there because as the quality of life improves on the coastland, now we see some of the production going inland where people are willing to work at lower rates. So we are observing some of that. What happens to the fiber is it developed in China, it's woven, knitted, finished, made into garments, and many times it comes back here. And that's one of the reasons that there is an assessment of these goods coming back in to help allow us in our research promotion of cotton. So when we promote cotton, we're promoting this cotton, and chances are some of the fibers in here are from other producing countries of the world. China is the number one producer of fiber. India is number two. The U.S., I believe, Steve, is number three. Brazil is growing in production.
Okay, so the question is, what's happening here toward a transition to dry land farming?
At Bayer, one of the things we're doing is through our breeding programs, we are developing cottons that you would categorize as falling into abiotic stress, cottons that are much more susceptible or less susceptible to water stress and can be utilized more importantly in the dry land area. So that's one of the things we're doing.
I just have when I do these things, I think, well, you should make some suggestions. So, one of the sort of things on my invisible PowerPoint was these sort of suggestions, and one of them is, that when we look at how we can, individual farmers really work on a very, very small margin. A lot of people think that farmers are making a bunch of money, and, I think that we look at sort of, large-scale farm sort of productions and look at their, margins. They're very different than an individual farmer. And so, when you're asking people to move more towards drip or you're asking them to, the prices of these, genetically modified seeds, these creatively enhanced seeds, They might have great impacts, but they're extremely expensive. And so when you look at sort of the, you know, the line items of farming now, pesticides are very expensive, you know, fertilizer are very expensive, but the seeds themselves are very, very expensive. So I think that one of the things that we need to look at in the same way that we've sort of encouraged and incentivized drip and that sort of technology, we need to look at incentivizing other types of technology. So if there are seeds that are more drought resistant or that move people away from the necessity to water as much, you know, there may be opportunities, policy opportunities there to sort of encourage the use of those seeds. Because I think it's very easy to say, well, can't you just put those things in? And you know, but when you start looking at the margin that a farmer is working on, especially when there's been two drought years basically back to back, to ask somebody to put in drip or to buy a bunch of genetically modified seeds, those numbers just, they're not reasonable. They literally can't feed their family. So, you know, we need to look at sort of the true economics of it and understand it from an individual farmer perspective. So I just wanted to kind of add that onto the, there's a lot of creative things going on, but it's very expensive.
I'd like to respond a little bit to that. We actually don't ask them to buy it. We produce, again, a solution, and there has to be, you know, a return on that investment. And I understand when you have unusual drought situations like we've had the last couple of years, that could be an issue. But we also have a program for that. We give them some rebates back and incentive or help offset some of those problems with the farmers. So if they have a if they have a crop failure, then we have a replant policy. Or we also provide them some of the money back. You know, so we partner with them. We want to make sure we keep that customer.
One interesting technology that is not being developed in Texas Tech, but by a local entrepreneur.
Oh, could you speak into the mic? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So there's an early stage technology being developed by a tech grad who is an entrepreneur and engineer. And he may be working with some of the folks at the Ag Extension, but nevertheless, and I don't even know where in the process of commercializing this and how market ready it is, but it's technology called, I think the name is SmartField. I don't know if anybody knows, and David Sharbat is the CEO, but it's a technology where there can be readings of the crops, and based on the disposition of the plant, the leaves, or whatever disposition of the plant structure, it can then water that plant in the areas where it gives the reading that it needs water. So it's really interesting. I'm happy to give folks the name and number. David's a great guy, but that's one technology that could make for more sustainable.
Now, we now know that when future scholars research the origin of the term creatively enhanced organisms, it's right here. Right, CHOs. Okay, anybody else? Okay, I'm going to pose one. If the refined climate models are correct, we're going to have a future in the western half of Texas where we have occasionally it'll rain 10 inches between 6 a.m. and noon and no other time. This is obviously going to lead to an increased reliance on groundwater. What is the industry doing to prepare for this kind of climate change?
Let me say, is this on? Yeah, we are taking these possibilities very seriously, looking at how, and these are serious discussions now, how will you farm with climate change? What the answer is, we don't know. But we do believe that necessity is, in other words, when you have a crisis, ensuing crisis, we've got to do something. And, you know, whether it's improved use of precision application water, very important, very great potential. If it's affordable next year, I doubt it. If it's affordable 10 years from now, probably. Also, looking at the plant itself to make it more, resistant to the stresses.
you have a drought-resistant seed that's developed, then it rains 10 inches, what happens? That's part of the trade-off that you're continuing to look at. But, yes, it's on top of mind. It's many, many scientists. Do we have the solution? Not yet, but, you know, I still believe we're on this road of continuous improvement, and we will continue to find ways to deal with it.
So, from a bringing technology to bear on solutions for the problem that you mentioned, and this is again 40,000 feet up, but Texas Tech, as you guys have probably heard, is very involved in wind energy and R&D. And so what we've done in the past, and we look to do, and we're working on a project now that we hope we'll get some funding from the state, some support, and that's using wind energy to desalinate the brackish water from the underground water supply, which I think there is much more water than and I don't know the numbers, but it's brackish water. So if you can solve the problem of desalinating brackish water, there's a lot of application and economic and sustainability impact both in the ag sector and in the energy sector with hydraulic fracking and the large amounts of water that is used there. So that's a project we're excited about. We worked with GE in the past and the city of Seminole, but we want to expand that going forward.
Another project that I've heard about that I'm not involved in is looking at natural recharge features, of which up here there's not many because the landscape has been changed considerably by farming. It looked very different, you know, a few hundred years ago. And so looking at things like playa lakes that do gather water but have, you know, a clay liner, which is what keeps the water actually on the surface, and figuring out are there ways that we can use playa lakes as recharge features. Currently, you know, the recharge rate is extremely slow for the Ogallala, so there are some sort of hydrological solutions that look at sort of these, how can we capture these large rain events and not sort of lose them, you know, be able to take advantage of them. Obviously, surface reservoirs around here don't make a whole lot of sense with the wind and the sun. The evaporation rate is just off the charts. So if we can get that water underground, that might be another way. So there are some projects looking at that as well, both in this area and other parts of Texas.
Thank you for that question. The question was the fact that we are reporting that pesticide usage has decreased or insecticide usage has decreased, is that because of biotechnology? The answer is that is a very important component. As far as insecticides on cotton, in the United States, two things have happened, and they happened, fortunately, parallel. One was a boll weevil eradication program. The boll weevil was, if it's where it is, it's a devastating pest. It's really interesting. This insect typically started feeding on the cotton very, very early, and that created a problem. We got on a treadmill of insecticide uses. The boll weevil appeared early in the spring, so you begin spraying it. And what happened, that interrupted a good integrated pest management program with spraying. By spraying for the boll weevil, it killed the weevil, you know, for that week, but it also killed beneficial insects. With the beneficial insects being gone, then the boll worm is an opportunist. It comes in, eats the plant. So then it required insecticides to take care of the boll worm, to the point we own this treadmill. So many, many years ago, the industry decided we must take the boll weevil out, eradicate it. Now, a boll weevil is easy, theoretically easy to eradicate in the U.S. because there's only one host plant, that's cotton. So it's not going to survive on corn and soybeans and my roses and so on. So a research laboratory was set up to study the life habits, the sex habits, the feeding habits of the boll weevil, and that was developed a synthetic pheromone which mimics the pheromones that the weevils put out, and it attracted female female weevils. apparently. That's the way the story goes. So understand, with the ability now to detect the presence of a weevil with traps used all across the U.S., to eradicate the weevil, it took cooperation of every cotton grower in the United States, every state that involves cotton, the federal level, and the cotton growers paid for an eradication program which used a holistic approach of the understanding the sex habits of the weevil. It understands the overwintering habits, you know, how does it survive during the winter. We were able to break that cycle, remove the weevil, and then we allowed the beneficial insects to live longer in the field to continue to take care of whatever worms were there. At the same time, and this is really important, a technology called BT. That was the ability for the cotton plant to mimic Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a naturally occurring bacterium, which was discovered in Japan around the turn of the century, more than 100 years ago. That toxin is only toxic to chewing insects, that is worms. By taking that out, then the total insecticide load really went down. Now, are insecticides still needed? Yes, there are other critters that are not affected by these technologies, such as stink bugs. They're not affected by these, so they see an opportunity and they love to chew on the plant. But net-net, it's a great, yeah. Actually, stink bug is a sucking insect, and that's a different category. Yeah.
Oh, it stinks and sucks. Okay.
Good.
All right.
Okay.
Anybody else? Any more questions?
You got it.
Go. Okay, so the question is, what are the prospects and the status of switch to alternative crops?
I can just have one sort of anecdotal story, is that when I was at EDF, we did a project, was sort of part of our, I know I'm not supposed to use the word sustainable. You've taken a lot of words out of my vocabulary today.
I still use it.
Okay. Lastability. What can we do for the survival of the Ogallala? Because, you know, I'm a water resources person. So we thought about, well, what would happen if, could we do a model where we ask farmers to switch to a switchgrass or a natural grass that could then be used for a biofuel, but in a sort of more water-saving way, not a corn ethanol or something like that. And so we did this sort of pretty in-depth economic study that was assumed a carp. This was a little ways back when we were hoping we would have a cap and some sort of carbon payment. So we took a blanket number for a carbon payment. We looked at what they would save on water, which is not much here because they don't pay for the water. So, you know, if they already had a pump, that wasn't necessarily a saving. So we looked at, you know, well, is it a diesel pump? Would we save them on diesel? We tried to look at every sort of revenue stream that was possible. And, you know, we had sort of a pot of money that we'd gotten from a settlement with an energy company, actually, that we could sort of pay them for this pilot project. And I will tell you, the numbers were terrible. We looked at, well, just for the switchgrass, if we said, well, if they got this amount and they got this amount for a carbon payment, you know, what that acreage would get, even in a low-yield dry land cotton, was just not comparable. Now, whether or not you want to get into, well, they have some subsidies on that or whatever, those are the checks they have coming in for cotton. And so then we looked at, well, okay, well, what if they added wind turbines on there? Would that add enough? Or what if they also used it for grazing? I mean, my hope was that you could have sort of a carbon savings with the sort of the biomass underneath. You could cut it. You could sell that. You could do it for – and we just couldn't make the numbers work with the current – I mean, it wasn't even close. I mean, I had some really great farmers that really opened their books to me and said – this is how much I make. This is how much I would need to make to make that worth it, which was really, I really appreciated their sort of openness, and the numbers, they just weren't even close. So even with a high carbon payment, and we couldn't blow the carbon payment out the roof to make it work because that wouldn't have been realistic under a carbon market. So that at least was my experience for that. Now, whether or not over time that number would change, I don't know. And obviously you're never going to, I mean, it would take a lot unless water just ran out to get that full transformation, because obviously you have tractor supply, seed supply, all those people. But we were just thinking, well, you know, for some people, you know, we have newer generations here that don't want to farm. You know, maybe they could put this in. It's very low maintenance. They don't have to work. And the numbers were terrible. So we sort of, our project died. But that, you know, we got some really interesting numbers out of it.
May I add to that? One of the real pleasures or benefits of being an independent consultant, I can work on some things, not cotton. And one of my clients is, we are looking at exactly addressing your question, what other things can be done productively, economically. One of the things that I'm helping this company look at is alternative feedstocks for chemicals, fuel ethanol. You know, that's kind of low down on the chain. Developing chemicals from sorghum. Sweet sorghum is growing. I was at Plainview yesterday working on some non-cotton issues. This is really important for the future. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on the economics, and it's going to depend on improving these other crops to the point that they can produce these chemicals that we need. When I say chemicals, they are replacement for petrochemicals, for making automobile tires, for high-valued oils, high-valued sugar-based crops. The word is that sugar is going to be the new oil. In other words, there's so many things you can get from the sugar molecule besides just more stuff around my belly.
In an experience going back to fiber tech and an application that came about as a result of the BP oil spill, and this, you know, makes me think about the natural properties of versus synthetic, and may not be exactly your question, but we had taken FiberTech down to the Gulf, and it had absorbed, I think, 2.5 times more of the nasties in the water than the synthetic counterpart materials. I think for every 1 gram of cotton, there was 15 grams in its weight in chemical absorption. So it just reminds me that there's just sort of God-given structural properties that have extraordinary value that I don't know that you can get in synthetics. I think you do all the above on every strategy for solving problems, but just an example that of what cotton can do that I don't think I would have thought of initially, but thought I'd mention that. Yeah, it's a good product.
Thank you. I was in Norway last year, and I saw a display urging us not to wear blue jeans because blue jeans hurt the earth. And my immediate reaction was, I'd rather you want me to wear things made out of oil.
I will say that I saw a whole program about blue jeans were originally designed never to be washed. You were never supposed to wash your blue jeans. So back to what you were saying.
Wow.
That's how they got their pattern wear, was you were never supposed to wash your
jeans. So stop washing your blue jeans right
you
now.
You can still wear them.
That's right.
Don't wash them.
Okay, thank you. Well, this has been so good that I've let us run over by about 8 minutes, but I don't want to cut into your break time anymore. If you go downstairs right now, you will find coffee and brownies. I want to thank our speakers. I have learned a great deal here. I think we've all learned from each other. I appreciate the collegiality and the effort to enlighten. So thank you very much. Yeah.